This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream. You're listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. On December 6th, 1989, 14 women were killed at École Polytechnique in Montreal. The gunman shouted, "You're all a bunch of feminists, and I hate feminists." On December 1st, 2012, Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter held their annual Montreal Massacre Memorial event at the Vancouver Public Library. This event remembers the 14 women who were murdered by a man simply because they were women. The event also addresses the fact that violence against women is systemic and happens within a context of a misogynistic culture, one that pretends abuse happens on an individual level rather than on a continuum. Patriarchy, rape culture, violence against women, sexism, objectification, incest, sexual harassment, porn culture, they're all interconnected and they're inseparable. On today's show, we're hearing excerpts from a panel discussion called "Pornifying Violence Against Women." The name of the panel was inspired by photos discovered this past year of an RCMP officer depicting scenes of violence against women, some of which were eerily similar to reports of what happened at the Picton farm. The photos led to a heated debate about public versus private, a concept that feminists have worked very hard to dismantle. We know all too well that violence against women is no fantasy. Speakers at the roundtable are, in order of appearance, Hilla Kerner, who is the facilitator and is a collective member at Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter, Suzanne Jay of Asian Coalition Ending Prostitution, Lisa Stacy, a collective member at Vancouver Rape Relief, Carissa Raponin of WAVA, Women Against Violence Against Women, Lierre Keith, a founding member of the group Stop Porn Culture, Janine Benedict, associate professor in the Faculty of Law at the University of British Columbia, myself, Megan Murphy, Trisha Bapti, a formerly prostituted woman and the founder of Eve, formerly Exploited Voices Now Educating, journalist Laura Robinson, Summer Rain Bentham, a collective member at Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter, and Shani, a survivor of prostitution and a member of La Clé, Coalition Against Sexual Exploitation. Here is that discussion.
It was surprising to realize that it's been a long time since we have a public conversation among ourselves about pornography. Usually the public discourse is degradation or self-sexual liberation. But in the last years, we focused to talk with each other about other forms of male violence against women and prostitution, and the arguments are similar, but we thought it useful to focus today on pornography in terms of violence against women. We also noticed in the crisis line that the relationship between pornography and violence against women were always there, and each woman can speak to that. But the more men have access to all kinds of machines, and the more social media, and people learn how to use YouTube and Facebook, it become more and more prevalence for men to document and reproduce the attack on women, and women are horrifying, calling us scared, ashamed, angry to find the image of the attack keep reproducing out there without their control. Experience that was used to be mainly for prostituted women or women in the porn industry became experience of many ordinary women who thought they were protected, and it's an opportunity for a call on solidarity from the average woman and to have another level of understanding how we all impacted by pornography. So my first question is, how do you define pornography?
Well, the formal definition is pictures of prostitutes. I think most people look at pictures of pornography and they think of all of the women in the pictures as prostitutes. Mm-hmm. And more and more, as there are different types of different genres of pornography, the groups of women that are depicted in the porn are more and more perceived, perhaps by the men who use it, as potentially prostitutes or sexually available to men in the same way that they're shown in the pictures.
Well, as a member of the Collective of Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter, we also belong to the Canadian Association of Sexual Assault Centers. And there's a resolution in the constitution of that pan-Canadian coalition of sexual assault centers that provides kind of our working definition of pornography. They've agreed on a definition of pornography that firstly recognizes pornography as a form of male violence against women, that depicts women and children as acceptable objects of sexual coercion, violence, degradation, and dehumanization. And in so doing, it legitimizes the roles of women and children as objects for the sexual and aggressive gratification of men. And this condones, reinforces, and institutionalizes the sexual and economic exploitation of women by men.
I want to build on what you just said, Lisa. I think that's really great. I also think that pornography delivers a patriarchal ideology of male dominance and female subordination. And it's not only about ideology, but I think it's about practice. I think it's a practice of the subordination, denigration, and dehumanization of women, and actually shows acts of violence against women that are happening in real time, in real life.
I always fall back on the definition that Andrew Dworkin and Catherine McKinnon came up with, which still stands the test of time, which is it's the graphic, sexually explicit subordination of women in pictures or words. And the only thing new in that legal definition is the word subordination, which frankly is a no-brainer. And the wonderful thing about their definition is that for it to be legally actionable under the law that they wrote is that pornography isn't just an image. Pornography is something that happens in the real world. So unless a real woman is forced into making it or a real woman is hurt because of it, it's not pornography. So pornography is what pornography does. It's a social act. So somebody actually has to be hurt. But we know that they can't make this material without a vast pool of hurt women on either end of it. So that's why I love that definition so much. It's so precise, and it gets to the heart of this, which is that it's real life. It's not just an image.
I guess I like all of these definitions, and I just wanted to add two things. One is that I think it's important to understand that pornography is also a tool or an aid for developing male sexuality. I mean, the purpose of pornography is for masturbation, and so it's actually a way of training boys' sexual responses. And so it makes a difference what those sexual responses are being trained to. The other thing I would say is that I think it's important to remember that pornography is an industry. It's a vast, incredibly profitable industry that makes some people, mostly men, very, very wealthy. And that profit is a big motivator. And there is a myth that a significant amount of the pornography that you see on the internet is amateur pornography. And that is something that the industry very carefully controls. They like to have a veneer of amateur porn and give you the idea that, in fact, a lot of it is that, when it's not at all. That's a product as well that's being marketed to draw you in, and then you start to pay. So I think that part of it as well, that pornography is an industry, is worth noting.
I think that, you know, there's that quote that's paraphrased a lot from a judge who said, "I can't define it, but I know it when I see it." And that's, you know, not necessarily useful, but it's true, because when you start to try to define pornography in a legal sense, a lot of people will understand it as obscenity or explicitness or just depictions of nudity or sexuality on screen, and that just doesn't capture what pornography is and why pornography is dangerous and destructive, because it doesn't get to that objectification and the sexualization of violence. And Andrew Dworkin, of course, said pornography is something that happens to women. And that speaks to that objectification and the male as the aggressor or the active participant who's doing something to women. Women are just there as an object of the male gaze.
I just wanted to say something Janine picked up on was she said pornography is for the purpose of masturbation. I would also add to that that it's kind of a guidebook on what to demand from prostituted women and what to demand from their girlfriends. So I don't think it's just for masturbation anymore.
Yeah.
It's this legal or whatever you want to phrase it kind of guidebook of, look, she does it, you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's created this, it's almost solidified, not solidified, but it's their demands are now front and center, and look, it's legitimate because she did it on film.
Yeah, actually, I'd like to agree with that, and I forgot to say that I also have spent years looking at the rape culture of junior hockey, and what I've noticed, not just in the sexual assaults that I've been investigating in junior hockey, but also in other gang sexual assaults, that there's always a camera, there's always a cell phone taking the pictures and broadcasting the pictures, and so there is a new kind of technological violence against women, because you are so, they have taken so much control of your body that now you're on the net too. And I think that this is a very important component, because what I have been watching in when I'm reading about how these gang rapes have worked, it's all for those guys now. It's like it doesn't exist. We haven't really raped her until she's on the net, until we share this with the other guys. And so there's a kind of a deeply perverse male bonding amongst those kinds of guys, and I think there's a huge amount of men who would find that deeply perverse to imagine. But in the way in which those boys and young men and men understand masculinity, they understand it as such an incredibly powerful way of harming women that it's your job almost as a team or as a group of guys to do the absolute most harm you possibly can in terms of, you know, making her body available now to everyone else.
If you can be explicit or concrete, in what way pornography is harmful to women?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that pornography teaches women that they exist for male pleasure. So that their value is in their bodies, that their value is in their sexualization, that they're objects of male desire. And so either we can perform to the male gaze or we cannot, and we can be invisible, and either way we're punished, and we're sort of tricked into believing that the only way we can gain power in this world is by being desired and to be objects, sexualized objects. And that's sort of part of how we end up with this confused discourse around the empowered porn star, the empowered stripper, because in that moment there's this false power that doesn't extend onto anywhere else in the world, but essentially it teaches us that we're not valuable, and so we keep grasping for this thing that we can never really have.
I think pornography is harmful to women and girls in a lot of ways. I think it shapes, as we're growing up, I think it shapes and depicts part of our sexuality and our identity, how we're supposed to look, who is desirable in most cases, and what we should change or do to ourselves to meet that image or that expectation in order to achieve that unattainable standard or level, and what we should and shouldn't be willing to do. I think it teaches us that we're a commodity and that we can be bought, but I think it's more harmful to us that it teaches men that. And I think it affects every single woman, and I don't think any of us are free from it as long as there's one woman who can be bought or one woman who's a commodity, any one of us can be. And I think that it's used against us when we're not willing to do the acts that men see in pornography, in our relationships, in our friendships, and on the crisis lines. Women call after being attacked, whether it's physically or sexually by their partner, when they won't perform to the level or the standard that men think that they're entitled to based on
the pornography that they're viewing. So is there a punishment for the refusal to act a porn scenario?
Mm-hmm. And women in prostitution are bought, especially Aboriginal women in prostitution, are bought on the street to perform some of the most heinous acts that are viewed in pornography.
It doesn't show consensual sex. So the idea of consent as explicit, enthusiastic, ongoing is completely undermined by the kind of sex that's represented in porn. And when women call us, the things that men say to them when they're attacking them bear remarkable resemblance to the things that men say to women in pornography, which is what I've seen in pornography is that even if she tells you to stop at some point, she's going to love it eventually. And I think that men take that message away from pornography, and I think that I hear it on a daily basis from the women that call, that they take that to heart as what sex looks like.
Pornography is really harmful for lesbian, for all women, but for lesbian too. Even it's like mostly represent like heterosexual sexuality, because it's denied that a woman can have an autonomy on her sexuality and between other women, that they can like get out of the man control. So it's denying that. And also the lesbian sexuality is appropriate in pornography. There is really like horrible porno scene that is like not even like true lesbian in life that are shown together, and lesbian sexuality in pornography is only like for men pleasure, and I think that lesbian sexuality isn't at all for men pleasure. So it's really saying even if you try to escape the private appropriation of men, you're still appropriate collectively. And even we can have access to your like process of autonomy in your sexuality as woman. So for me, it's really harmful as a lesbian.
So clearly the flourishing of the porn industry is fed by the greed, by the love of money. And surely the pornographer probably love money even more than he hates women. But I do think that it's not just what motivates the industry is to make the money, but I think the consumption or the production of such huge amounts, the normalization of it, I see as an immediate clear backlash to the gain women make. And there is I'm sure if we will have the chart of seeing how many women are earning more, how many women have more access to public spaces, to some authority position, there will be probably fairly direct relationship with how much more pornography is existing and how much more violent and more degrading it is. But this is what an assumption that I want to discuss with you. Is it collective punishment for women for the achievements that women have made?
I think so. Actually, that's something that I've been thinking about recently. And I've been thinking about that a lot as we make more gains, as we'll make more gains here in Canada, and then we see this this growth, this huge growth in porn industry. In a way, I think it has to be linked to that backlash. It is part of the backlash. And I'm thinking, I don't want to get into too many like graphic details about pornography, but I remember reading something that Robert Jensen wrote about a particular type of pornography, and how it's actually punishing women for speaking their mind. It's like it's a physical punishment. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think absolutely.
I think if you look at the non-mainstream porn or the pornography that comes out of men attacking women in particular, I think it directly relates to keeping women down or punishing women for the gains that they've made. Men and boys use pornography to punish women, and in particular example was a young girl who was gang raped at a party in a barn in Pitt Meadows 2 years ago. Hundreds of people were in attendance. There was multiple photos taken, distributed via cell phones and on Facebook. And these are new tools that men didn't used to have. Social media and cell phones are being used to create and distribute pornographic scenes. But also the severity of those attacks and the number of people who are witnessing those attacks and remaining silent. And I think the acts that are played out in those attacks are based on what men and boys are watching in pornography. By photographing or capturing the individual attack and then reproducing it is a way to shame her or silence her even more. Mm-hmm. And to encourage camaraderie among each other as men and boys. And it's almost like in a way a weird sense of rite of passage formation in young boys, especially at parties. We're seeing more and more often the photographs of girls being taken and then distributed later. It's not often that it makes it to the media. This one did. And not only were the kids there silent, the community was silent. And hundreds of people saw the images.
I think it might be, if we're going to talk about that case, I think it would also be relevant to bring up the Amanda Todd case, mm-hmm. in that it's been so labeled as bullying, and it's like this blanket statement that, whereas it's actually child pornography. Mm-hmm. Like an older man in New York got her to take pictures of her breasts, and he blackmailed her with them. And at no point really in the media do we hear child pornography, do we hear sexual assault, do we hear any of the actual facts. And it's covered under this very obscure, non-judgmental almost, non-gendered, non-everything, like non-racialized, non-word of bullying. And I think that's an important case to bring up because so many minor girls are being coerced into taking explicit photos of themselves and then either being blackmailed with them or find it on Facebook or wherever, which is a form of pornography.
I just wanted to add something in terms of the harms of pornography. And I think often, certainly the legal system, often when I talk to audiences that include men about pornography, the idea that they have in their minds is that there needs to be some kind of scientific proof that normal men exposed to pornography then commit acts of violence against women that they wouldn't otherwise commit. Like that's kind of the idea of what we need to show to prove that pornography is harmful. And I actually think even on that point the evidence is surprisingly good and that people don't necessarily want to admit that, particularly for certain men. But I think one of the reasons that that's becoming increasingly an irrelevant question is because there is no outside of pornography. Like there is no person not exposed to pornography who can then be exposed to it and in a laboratory and then we somehow measure whether they're aroused by it or whether their attitudes towards women change. Now, because of the technology, my child's school bus is full of pornography because everybody's got an iPod Touch or whatever, this building, right, is full of pornography. So there are no more porn-free spaces. It's very difficult to have a porn-free sexuality, I think, for young people to sort of not be exposed to it in any way. And the industry has been very deliberate in, when they started to see women's opposition to pornography, to co-opt women into it, right? To say, in fact, this is not just something for men, this is for you too. And this is your sexuality reflected back to you. So I think in terms of measuring the effects that it has, you have to go much deeper than simply saying, does pornography make normal men rape? I actually think that what's unfortunate is that pornography now makes normal men and normal women. It's part of just a kind of normal, and I use that word, obviously, I mean in terms of dominant or standard sexual development.
Just a quick point to add to that is that, the lines between pornography and mainstream media are blurred now. So pornography has been mainstreamed, and that's why we talk about things like pornographic. We see pornographic images that aren't technically pornography, which is why you know, defining porn based on explicitness or obscenity or even just nudity is problematic because it doesn't describe the imagery and why that imagery is pornographic. Yes. Yeah. And, you know, the point that you made around the increase in pornography being related to women's gains is interesting because that mainstreaming of pornography is now tied to female empowerment. So we're told that we can objectify ourselves now and that we can be empowered by emulating pornography and creating our own porny images, but we're in charge of it now. So it's our sexuality, as you talked about.
I think one other thing that pornography does that's really detrimental to women is it doesn't give us space to explore our own authentic sexuality, because pornography makes women an object for men's sexual gratification, and women have to perform for men's pleasure. So where's the space for women to actually find out what works for us, what's pleasurable for us? And as pornography becomes more and more mainstreamed, and it's everywhere on billboards, wrestling now too, everywhere, where is there space to really explore their own sexuality? And also for young boys, where we're telling them this is what women are valued for. Women are objects to be fucked.
It also forces women to separate ourselves. Like it splits us from each other, because there's this constant vigilance about saying, I'm not that woman, or I'm not the type of woman that would do what you're seeing in those magazines or on the internet. So I think it serves a really important function of keeping us split from one another.
And speaking of split, I think we're intentionally encouraged to, as we are in other topic of violence against women, we're encouraged to talk about the battered woman, we talk about the rape victim, and if we touch on prostitution, we're encouraged to separate those forms of violence, and I think we're also encouraged to separate such a sister phenomena as a prostitution and pornography. So I want to ask if you agree with me that it's very rare to have this conversation together unless feminists making it, and what's the advantage of, why is the interest to, when there is a public conversation, to keep those two topics separate?
It's, for me, we cannot separate pornography no more than her sexuality, and we cannot separate rape than pornography, and we cannot separate sexual harassment from pornography or sexuality and everything. All is mixed up because it's, for me, it's really being part of a continuum of violence and a continuum of appropriation of sexuality of women. So we're really in a pornographication of the society, and all social relations are tainted by pornography. But pornography is coming not like from a psychotic vision, it's like really coming for a concrete story of sexual assault, of rape, and everything. And for me, I cannot really separate, I'm going to be really intimate here, I cannot separate the rape that I have lived than prostitution. For me, it's the same appropriation of my body, of like my integrity, of my dignity. It's like isolated the problem and saying that actually this is like a problem and we have to only solve some peripheric things. But for me, it's central. So we have to, I love the concept of the constraint to sexualities. And that for me is, I love this concept because it doesn't like say, okay, you have rape, you have pornography. It's being part of a continuum of constraint of women's sexuality.
I think rape and sexual assault exist because men have political, economical, and class and race power over women. I think wife assault exists for the same reasons. I think incest exists for the same reasons. And I think pornography contributes and fuels all of these reasons. So in my mind, they're inseparable. You cannot separate them. And that in each act, it is a way of men enacting that power and control.
Also, women's lives don't fit into those categories. Mm-hmm. They experience all sorts of violence. So we get a call on the crisis line from a woman whose husband wants her to do something that he saw in pornography. Maybe she complies, maybe she doesn't. Let's say she doesn't. He beats her until she submits and then rapes her. So she's wife assault, pornography, all of those things happen at the same time to the same women. And so creating these categories of violence against women undermines the fact that, as Shawnee said, they all interplay and intersect in women's lives.
Also, just a story that I've been hearing more and more. In my first maybe 10, 15 years being a feminist activist, this was not a story that I heard much. I hear this more and more now, and I think this has everything to do with the internet and the Facebook and all the social media, but women who have been raped, whether or not they were officially part of the industry, and then the rape's been documented with the cell phone or the camera or whatever, and now it's out in the public realm, and now they are further targeted by men who recognize them on the street or at work or at school. And that didn't exist 20 years ago, to my knowledge. I'd never heard that story before, and now I hear it all the time. So they've created a whole other class of victims, of women who can be victimized by simply posting those videos or those photographs in social media. It's like now you can identify her as, quote, a whore, which means she's public property, and now other men recognize her, and they do the same thing. And so they're talking about multiple levels of victimization each time.
Cherry Smiley, who's been on a few panels, is actually researching the fairly new phenomenon of Aboriginal women and girls in pornography, specifically a site that was launched called Indian Girls, NDN, like the letters, girls. It came about in 2010. And it really pornifies the violence that Indigenous women and girls face in a colonialist state, right? And the guy who runs it, originally these women were prostituted women who got involved in prostitution, and the guy actually blogs about where you can find these girls to go and perpetrate the violence upon them that you see in the pornography that he created with them. And he's very honest in saying that he goes to the welfare office to recruit these girls and goes to the unemployment office to recruit these girls. And so I think for me, when we're talking about pornography, the one thing that I've always been really aware of is just how utterly racialized it is and how it seems to be the last place where you can be utterly and completely racist and yet in everyday life not be considered racist.
Okay, so now it's obviously it's shitty, and so I can tell you the other sentence that I hadn't didn't plan to say, because we already talked in the first session about the police and how hard it is to get the police, in the state agents, to do what they're supposed to do, protect women from male violence. But some of the things that happened in the media this year is that the inadequacy, the shameful refusal of the police to protect the women in the downtown east side, and what we know from our anti-violence work, all women from all from male violence. And then the flood of complaints about sexual harassment that Catherine Guilford and then hundreds of women who've been serving in the RCMP through the years filed. And the revelation that the VPD officer have been watching porn on site on their police computer, and the RCMP officer who've been portraying pornographic images of him in a violent act against women, duplicating scene from the pig farm. It was so obvious, like, you treat women like shit, you treat women like shit, you treat women like shit. You cannot separate the sexual harassment that women in the police experience from their male co-worker, to the fact that these male co-workers refuse to deal with the death of the women, and with the fact that those men are watching porn as part of their 9-to-5 work. So it is shitty. And the question is, what can we do about it?
Can I just add something just before, sure, about the police officers? Yes. What I thought was very interesting about the police response to the officer found to have, you know, been involved in the online porn was how they were able to separate in their own minds that from the officers using porn at work. And they said, well, you know, obviously we're disturbed by these photographs, but we can't really see what the basis is for discipline because he was doing it on his private time, and because all the participants in the product consented to participating in this pornography, which I think is really fascinating because it shows you, first of all, again, the myth that feminists have worked so hard to fight against of this division between public and private, right? That there's a private sphere where nothing counts and nothing matters, and people always consign pornography to that sphere. It's done in private, therefore it has no impact on anything. And because, again, it was an attempt to kind of segment out this behavior under the label of consent. And what I increasingly see is I think that there was a time, 20 years ago maybe, when there was at least some recognition that there was a subcategory of pornography that was beyond the pale, right, that sexualized violence in really graphic ways and that we ought to be concerned about. Now that pornography is just called BDSM, no matter how violent and degrading it is, no matter how far removed it is from the kind of trappings even of traditional sort of BDSM ideas. And so therefore it's normalized too, because everybody consented to participate in it. And I don't understand why that officer was not fired immediately upon those pictures being discovered. You know, and then the RCMP's, fine, if he fights that, he fights that. That's 10 minutes after those photographs were discovered, he should have been fired and never allowed to have contact with another woman in his role as an RCMP officer. Again, I think it's shameful that the RCMP did not respond in that way.
Following up your previous argument, Janine, that there are those who are saying, show me the evidence that what you watch has anything to do with what you do after. And the only reason that Coca-Cola and McDonald's are such a powerful empire is it's because of the power of commercial. So if commercial is so effective in every person's life, why would the commercial for rape would not be that effective? So what can we do? We can start small with the men that we have sex with. We can dream big. What can we do to challenge porn?
Well, I like to go back to what I said in the morning in terms of claiming public space. I think when women do claim public space with their own version of their body and their own version of what they're going to do in public space, that makes a very powerful statement, especially when it's groups of women. And they're not apologetic. Even in England, they looked at the number of cyclists who were killed, and there were a lot more women cyclists killed than men. And I think it was because the women were basically riding as far right, like on the curb as they could, because they didn't think they could really take any space up on their bicycles. You know, so there's that kind of apologetic body that we learn to have in public space that we have to teach girls. I mean, a very, very big reason why I coach girls is because I want them to be out there with those healthy, strong bodies that can really kick and punch and run if they need to. And if they don't need to, they can still do it for fun because they can play soccer. But it's so important, I think, for all of us to be sort of honorary aunties and for the men who care deeply, and I know there are lots of them, and I know many of them who care deeply about girls, that they be the honorary uncles of all the girls out there who are going to stand up and be proud and not apologize for being in that space, and then challenge when we have, as I said this morning, when we have so much public funding going to things like celebrating the male violence of hockey, you know, the NHL playoffs, that we have parents and aunties and uncles who challenge that. And I'm helping them with that case. And so there's lots of things we can do on a small level and on a big level and not buy into the absolutely mindless crapola of whatever it is that's handing over all this public space to that theater of masculinity that is so violent. And by definition, women are only adjectives in that theater.
I mean, I think there's lots of different ways that we can go about challenging pornography. And so one of those ways is, of course, in education and in changing the discourse, because I think that's part of what, you know, it's confusing for people because they've been indoctrinated their whole lives to think that pornography is normal and that pornography equals sex. That's what sex is. And especially men who've been watching pornography since they were boys. I mean, that's what they know, and they think it's normal, and they think that it's a rite of passage. And I talk to a lot of men in my personal life about pornography. I talk to men who are porn consumers in my own life, and these ideas had never occurred to them before. They're not bad men. That isn't to say that they're... I mean, there are a lot of bad men out there who use porn and don't give a shit what we think about it, but, you know, for those men... You know, these are not bad men, they're progressive men, and it's just never occurred to them that pornography wasn't okay and it wasn't just a normal part of everybody's lives, mm-hmm. and that, you know, there could possibly be anything wrong with it.
As with many things, I think a multi-pronged approach is kind of the best way to go. I think individually, as individuals, we can decide that we're not going to use pornography in our own lives. I think, again, we can talk to the people in our lives. I think talking to men, as you were saying, is so important. Challenging their thinking, challenging the idea that pornography is all right. I think another thing that's really important is oftentimes when people critique pornography, it gets conflated with being anti-sex. And I think speaking out against that is incredibly important because we're not anti-sex. We're criticizing a violent form of masculinity that subjugates women. So I think talking about that's incredibly important. I think having gatherings like this where our feminist voices are heard is incredibly important because mainstream media doesn't give a lot of space to our voices. And then if we are in the position to draft up legislation or to challenge these things on systemic levels, I think we need to do that as well. So I think it's coming at it from all different directions.
Well, we've decided that it's important to keep the two, prostitution and pornography, connected to one another, to not accept some kind of trade-off between let us have our porn and you can have abolition or a form of abolition. So that's one step that we've decided to take. But as Janine pointed out, porn is an enormous capitalist enterprise. Like, there are huge economies that depend on it. It generates more money than all of organized sport combined. So I think that as with prostitution, one of the ways that we can chip away at pornography is that we can find ways to make the women less available to the pornographers. Give them other options. Mm-hmm. Give us other options. And both in presenting alternative ways of dealing with sexuality, but also in just giving women a pipeline out of porn and prostitution.
I think it's you got to start with not consuming pornography yourself, to ask the men in your life if they watch pornography, if they go to strip clubs, if they buy women, and challenge them on this behavior, and to not accept anything lower than that standard, and to have those men challenge other men in their lives on those same behaviors and ask for them not to do so.
Well, I agree with, I think the point's been made a few times, but Summer just made it, how we can kind of, as individuals in our relationships, challenge pornography's role in shaping our sexuality, the sexuality of the men that we express our sexuality if we're heterosexual with. And I think for me, what's important is to, like Suzanne said, keep the discussion of pornography connected to other discussions about male violence against women. I think that from my position of answering the crisis lines pretty much every day, I see the connection borne out again and again and again. And I think there's still a notion of pornography as an idea or a fantasy or entertainment, and I think we still have to keep insisting, to quote Andrea Dworkin again, it's something that really happens to real women. The women in the pornography, the women who have pornography made of their rapes, the prostituted women who are demanded to perform the most degrading acts seen in pornography, it really happens to real women, and I think we need to keep reminding everybody of that every chance we get.
Well, I agree with absolutely everything we've all said, and my emphasis always is on structural change, on material change. So I think we do need legal approaches to this. And one thing that's really hopeful, I don't know if everybody here knows this, but in Norway, I mean, not only do they have the Nordic model there, but they outlawed using women's bodies in advertising. I mean, this is not a utopian novel I read 20 years ago. They have outlawed using women's bodies in advertising. It's a completely different cultural landscape. And honestly, if they can do it there, there's no reason we can't do it in other places. Now, in the United States, we've got a very different sort of legal arrangement. I mean, we don't actually have human rights in our Constitution, so it's a really uphill battle. But honestly, we just got to start suing these fuckers. really. Until we hit their piggy banks, nothing's going to change. Because right now, it's all profit, right? They're nothing but rewarded for this. And the only thing that's going to change is when they start having to pay for it. So we've got to hit them however we can.
I, too, agree with everything that's been said so far, especially making and keeping the link between prostitution, pornography, strip clubs, like all facets of the sex industry. As a parent of teenage boys and young boys, I think we have a responsibility to start having our conversations with our children, especially our boys, long before the age of 11 when they'll see their first image of pornography. I know I have the conversations with my boys, much to their chagrin, actually their horror. And I think one thing that women can do is we can learn how we like to have sex. Like, I think as women, we really need to reclaim our sexuality and learn all over again how we like to have sex. And stick to that and refuse to have sex with men who don't value that if we have the ability to say no to them. So find the way we want to have sex and make sure we're only having that sex with men who will value our opinions and what our desires actually are.
These are all very good ideas. I guess I want to only add to that in terms of the audience. I know that sometimes people feel very overwhelmed by the scale of this, and they think, how can I take on a multi-billion dollar industry? And I do think that in terms of public action, it actually doesn't take very many people to start having some effect on public consciousness. I know that the porn producers say that there was a time that they could expect feminist opposition every time they put on a porn trade show or they had one of their porn award ceremonies or whatever, that there would be some protesters there and that would get a little bit of media coverage. Or if something was published in the more mainstream that really appropriated pornography, you know, people would speak out against it. And so there was at least a little counter-narrative that the media gave a nod to. Of course, some people think that pornography objectifies women. And they say, the porn merchants, that has largely disappeared. They don't have to worry about that anymore. Nobody protest. I don't want to say nobody, but increasingly, you know, that's not a concern for them. And it only takes a few people to write a letter to the editor, to call in, to say, you know, I was very disturbed by your program, your ad, your interview. You know, I'm very disturbed that your convention center is hosting this porn trade show. I'm not calling you on a moral or religious basis. I'm calling you because I support the equality of women, and I want you to stop making money off the objectification of women. And if, you know, 10 people call the Abbotsford Trade and Convention Center or wherever the porn expo is this year, that will have an impact. It really doesn't take that much. Just stick your neck out a little bit. Then there's some momentum that builds around that point of view.
And that's it. My original speech was join a woman group or support one, but I could tell from the thing that we told to each other, you're already doing it from different fronts, and all the fronts are important because None of us is free until all of us are free. Right. Thank you very much. We will see you next time.
You just heard a roundtable discussion which took place at the Vancouver Public Library on December 1st, 2012, as part of Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter's annual Montreal Massacre Memorial event. The panel, called Pornifying Violence Against Women, was facilitated by Hilla Kerner. Speakers were Suzanne J., Lisa Stacey, Carissa Raponin, Lear Keith, Janine Benedict, Trisha Bapti, Laura Robinson, Shani, Summerine Bentham, and myself, Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.